Welcome to All Sides Weekend. I'm your host, Claire Roth. The first season of Stranger Things on Netflix opens with the adolescent stars of the show gathered in a circa 1980s basement rec room, engaged in a round of the fantasy role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons.
The Demogorgon is tired of your silly human bickering. It stops towards you. Boom! Fireball hit whale!
Will stop!
Boom!
Protect
it! It was in anger!
Fireball!
And fireball!
And there we hear dice rolling. They're facing the monster in-game of the Demogorgon. Some people credit the popularity of Stranger Things with a resurgence of interest in Dungeons & Dragons. And it comes amidst a larger growing interest in the $10 billion global tabletop gaming industry. In the United States, sales of tabletop games have grown by nearly 30% in the past 3 years. Coming up, we'll learn about a play opening this weekend in Columbus that's inspired by Dungeons & Dragons. Right now, we're going to talk about the explosion of tabletop gaming writ large. Joining us is the owner of Tabletop Game Cafe, Aaron Brown. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. Games like Scrabble, Monopoly, Clue, they've been around since the early 20th century, at least. But they used to be family affairs. They used to be confined to the home. What's changed?
I think you have a large change over with the popularity of the Settlers of Catan board game, which came from Germany. It kind of was part of this movement of German and European-based games.
And that happened in, what, the mid-90s that Settlers was created.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it was kind of the first, like, hybrid family-appropriate game, but had some of the strategy elements that hobby gamers were involved in for a long time, you know, more resource management, which, you know, a lot of those came out of, you know, war games and train games and games that were inspired by Dungeons and Dragons. If you look at the companies that were putting out hobbyist games, they were almost always game companies that also made war games, like Avalon Hill, or companies that also made role-playing games like Steve Jackson Games and TSR and Games Workshop, who's really well known for their Warhammer miniature-based game. But they also made, you know, some hobby board games. They were popular in the same community as the war gamers and the RPG people, but there was not big crossover appeal. There was a large barrier of entry to start playing them. They often took many hours and had a lot of genre attachment that if you weren't into the genre, you weren't going to be interested.
So they were niche. They were really for
very niche.
Really like,
yeah,
like people who are very into it as a hobby and might be interested, for instance, in fantasy if it's D&D or, you know, in the war genre, I suppose, if
right.
it's some of the other ones that you mentioned.
Yeah.
So how did it convert to being something for any layperson?
I still have no clue how it happened. It just happened. Like in like the early 2000s, these games just started showing up amongst your friends and whatnot. You know, I've been playing Dungeons and Dragons since I was in fourth grade. And so I've been going to the same, you know, kind of hobby stores for books and miniatures and paintbrushes and dice. And these games started showing up in those stores first. So the same place where I was going to buy books used to have this tiny section of these specialty, very niche board games. And then all of a sudden, there was one less shelf of RPG books, and now all these big box board games. And, you know, you talk to the staff that's there, and they're like, oh, you have to try this out. It's from Germany. You know, it's a resource management. You're going to collect resources and build new roads and cities. And, okay.
So for those of us who don't imagine being a city manager is a fun way to pretend to spend our time, tell us what's attractive about something like Settlers. First, explain how it works very briefly.
Sure.
And then tell us why it's fun. I don't know if that's a question one person can answer. But
So first off, Settlers is you have this hexagonal island that's made up of all these different types of land. And each one of these lands produces a different commodity. Brick and stone, wood, sheep, and wheat. And you're going to, on your turn, you roll a die, and you get the resource from the ones that are next to your settlements. So if I have a settlement that's next to plains, I'll get wheat from it. And then I can then use that on that turn or a future turn to upgrade my settlement to a city, to add new roads, to buy cards, which will do a random thing based upon what you pull. And that's it until you get the most number of points. And what I think is fun about it is like the strategy and thinking about how you're going to get to the end goal. Because in traditional American family games that we grew up with, like if you take the game of life, you're on a path. You roll the die, you move down the path. There's not a lot of choices to make. You know, you can choose to go the higher route or the lower route in life. I don't remember much past that. And then you pretty much just react to what happens.
Yeah.
But in these games, you know, you're like, oh, where am I going to build a road to? What other resource do I want to get? Do I want to get a bunch of cards or do I want to get a bunch of resources? Do I want to try to cut someone else off or do I want to, you know, skirt the side and go around someone? Having multiple paths to victory is what I think really makes a game like that.
Well, it seems like a lot of these new wave of games, more about strategy than it is about luck. I mean, you gave the example of life, and in life, a lot of it has to do with what you draw at the very beginning, and then you're incredibly locked in. And some could say something about the metaphor of that. But I think that as far as gameplay, which is supposed to be a little bit escapist, there's more of a thirst now for, oh, I really want to have a strategy game that isn't just chess.
Right. And, you know, since then, you know, we are in absolutely the golden age of board games. The number of games that come out each year is astronomical. And the production value of them just keeps getting better. And you keep thinking, oh, they can't come up with any new mechanic or they can't come up with any new theme. And then the next year, they surprise you. And now all of a sudden you can't stop talking about the new thing and then what's going to then spawn off that.
Mm.
And, you know, I attribute it a lot to, you know, the digital age, you know, and there's always this, oh, are people not playing board games because they're on the computer all the time? But I think that the connections that we can do through social media and through message boards and through crowdfunding, like that is enabling us to have a lot more connection to games and the ability for small creators to get feedback and to create their own game. And as a very small person team, they can then go ahead and produce a new game, get it out on the market, and then it can explode.
I really love that twist, that it's the internet that's allowing us to have this kind of in real life gaming community and this explosion of games where we play face to face. If you've just joined us, this is All Sides Weekend. I'm Claire Roth. My guest this hour, Aaron Brown of Tabletop Gaming Cafe. Also with us is the founder of the Beers and Board Games Club, Cheryl Harrison. Welcome, Cheryl.
Hi, good morning.
So tell us about this club. Why did you create it?
Sure. So I started getting interested in tabletop games a little over 5 years ago. A friend of mine inherited a bunch of board games from a coworker, and we had never heard of Settlers of Catan or Pandemic or some of the titles that he gave us. So we just started busting them out on Friday nights and really enjoyed them. So he moved away, and I didn't know anybody else who would play these games with me. So I had started to amass a little bit of a collection and had no friends. I sent out a tweet basically asking people to meet me at a bar one night to play Catan, and then 5 years later, we have about 1,400 people in the Beers and Board Games Club. We host, you know, 60 events a year, including a couple big fundraisers. We just had our 24-hour game marathon last weekend, raising $10,000 for Children's Hospital. So it's just a really fun way for the people in our club to connect with people in Columbus who they wouldn't necessarily otherwise have encountered all over the shared love of gaming.
Well, I want to talk about that. What do you think that a game can inspire socially that just a round of beers, for instance, can't?
Absolutely. So board gaming, you know, sort of forces cooperation. There's so many different types of games. So we play some games where literally you have to cooperate because you're all on the same team. We play games where, you know, it's social deception. So you're sort of lying to each other or trying to figure out who's lying. So it just kind of forces these interactions with people in a way that you wouldn't just go grab a beer with a stranger, but you will sit down and play a board game with a stranger.
That is so fascinating to me that it's you start from strangers, because I think that traditionally, at least the way that many of us conceive of board games, is something that like you do with your family because you don't know what else to do on Christmas. But now it seems like something that it's not just an activity to do with friends you already have, but it's a way that you can meet new people.
In Columbus, we are extremely gifted with the number of opportunities you have to meet and connect with people. We have one of the largest game conventions with Origins, and then there's CABS, beer and board games, and then an ever-expanding collection of stores. Guard Tower, which has been around for decades, just opened a new location. If it tells you anything about the popularity of board games right now, is when a lot of other retail markets are shrinking, you know, we're seeing more board game stores open in our area.
Yeah. And there's, what's it called? Beyond the Board in Dublin, as far as a game and hobby store goes. There's Kingmakers on Buttles. There's, of course, Tabletop Gaming Cafe. And then there's these pop-up places because your people like Cheryl are creating these activities to do in a bar anywhere. Not to mention, presumably, it's happening at home.
Sure. And you go to, I mean, if you go to most of the breweries in Columbus, they all have a small game library, even though that's not their main focus, because people are just looking for something to help connect with. I asked a lot of our members to sort of share with me what gaming has meant to them, knowing I was coming on here. And sort of a recurring theme with everyone's comments was that everything is so divisive right now in our culture, and gaming is one thing that just forces people to sit down at the table together and work together and have a good time together, no matter who they are or where they come from.
We are talking about tabletop gaming this hour on All Sides Weekend. My guests this hour, Aaron Brown, the owner of the Tabletop Gaming Cafe, and Cheryl Harrison, founder of the Beers and Board Games Club. Stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to All Sides Weekend. I'm Claire Roth, and this hour we are talking about the renaissance of tabletop gaming. Still with us is Tabletop Gaming Cafe owner Aaron Brown and the founder of Beers and Board Games Club, Cheryl Harrison. Also joining us now, Malika Jacobs, the owner of Kingmakers, a board game parlor near Goodale. And something that we haven't actually really dug into yet is what the landscape is like. Help those of us who don't play that many board games or who haven't really played anything since Scattergories came out understand what's out there right now.
Sure. So, yeah, Aaron did a great job touching on sort of the renaissance, starting with Settlers of Catan. But the industry has really seen an explosion in all sorts of different types of games. So there are two-player games. There's cooperative games, which Cheryl touched upon, where you're competing together against the board or the clock, or sort of you're working all everyone's working together. There's a lot of strategy games. So the spectrum of, extreme strategy to just lighter strategy games. And then there's a whole slew of party games, which is really what probably the most majority of people that are newer to board gaming know, just because of Cards Against Humanity and sort of the onslaught of games that came out with the apples to apples mechanic. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's just a huge gamut of a wide array of games out there. But I do think that for folks that haven't played a game since Monopoly or, you know, Scattergories, it's astonishing. And I think whenever you walk into, a place like Aaron's or a place like Kingmakers, people are just sitting there in awe of the amount of board games that are out there. And there's so many coming out all the time. So I think the job of, you know, the folks that are in the industry is to really talk about what they enjoy playing. You know, that's what we try to do at Kingmakers is really talk about what we like, you know, what's great, what's a great fit for people that haven't played a game since life. And, you know, how can we get people into that hobby and be less intimidating? Because I know it sounds strange that a board game could be intimidating, but
no, they are. I have gone to some of these board games bars with friends that are more, I would say, into it than I am.
Sure.
And it can feel overwhelming. So my question is, What makes a good game in your estimation?
You know, that's really, it's very personal. And I think as you get into the industry and the hobby, what you think is a good game probably changes. So it's sort of akin to being, you know, a foodie probably. You start with something, you get introduced to a cuisine and you start to discover it. And then as you get more into it, you sort of become, you know, a little bit, you not snobby, but sort of, you know, you think about the mechanics of the game more. You think more about what the ambiance it creates amongst the people that are playing.
So you start a little bit simple. Yes. Like crepes for French cuisine, yeah. Before escargot.
So our team talks about this a lot because I think we've graduated a lot of people that have come into Kingmakers. We've graduated them from being sort of really intimidated just discovering to being more thoughtful about what they play and are, you know, so I think that changes over time. But laughing, getting to do something that you might, entering a world that you might not otherwise enter, being able to do something that you might not otherwise do. We have we talk about being a kid again, just being able to relive sort of like it's okay to be competitive and it's okay to want to win. And but I think a whole slew of things that just, I mean, Aaron touched on it too, just being able to just work with other people and like just do something that you might not otherwise be able to do.
What do you guys think? What makes a good game in your estimation?
I'll tell you what makes a bad game. That's Monopoly. That's
one thing. Why is Monopoly bad?
Once you get into you know, gamers, everybody sort of has a shared disdain for that. And it's because the game was created as a way to show the evils of capitalism, right? So the game is intentionally unbalanced. And so you can be knocked out of the game very quickly if you unfortunately don't roll high numbers, you know, and get to move around the board correctly. So it's just very chance-based. And so there's plenty of games that I play that are luck-based, but not that eliminate players so much. You don't want to play a 3-hour game if someone can be out of the running within 20 minutes and then have to sit there for 3 hours and wait for everyone else to end. So a lot of the Euro games that we're seeing coming out.
And that's like Ticket to Ride, which is about building train links across a country or across a continent or, as we've mentioned many times, Settlers.
Sure. So lots of games that fit into that model or kind of the point salad thing where there's lots of different paths to victory, like Aaron was discussing, so that you're in the game the whole time. You might not even know if you won until the game is over. You're just having fun. You're making choices and you're interacting with your friends. You're not screwing them over necessarily in a way that they have to now sit there and watch you play the game. You can still screw them over, but at least you can all, you know, have fun together and one person's not just left in the corner.
What I think is amazing is that Monopoly was built to be a miserable experience and people love it. It's like blows my mind. And also,
do people love it though?
People still play it and they buy it.
I know one person who's a Monopoly adherent and I'll never understand it. But other than that, I feel like the kind of meme is that it gets us into fights with family, which is obviously not what you want in a game.
Well, there's plenty of games where you can fight with family in a fun way.
Yeah. Yeah. We have, you know, there's a lot of
agonizing
games out there, but they're fun. They're quick. You can jump back into it. Mm. You know, like you look at Love Letter, where you're just constantly knocking people out of the game, but you finish it in 15 minutes.
Right.
And that's too. There's more games that are more quick. Monopoly's also infamous, perhaps, for being hours long. But you have games, card-based games like Sushi Go, where you're trying to build different combinations of sushi for points, and those rounds go very quick.
Sure. My attention span for games is usually about 30 minutes, especially over the beers that we're usually having in our particular group. So I tend to like to go towards the shorter games because I get to play more games. I get to have lots of different experiences. I get to, you know, interact with different people at our events. One of my favorite short games I think came out this year is called The Mind, where all you are doing is playing cards that are numbered 1 through 100 in order. So the four of us would all have a card, except we're not allowed to talk. And so you have a 7 and Malika has a 4 and Aaron has a 99, and we just kind of stare at each other and try to guess when you think you should play your number so that they end up playing in order. So very simple concept, but just a lot of fun.
I love that because it's also something that if I had come up with that, would I imagine it would be fun? No, but it's this creativity of introducing that social aspect into something as simple as counting to 100.
Yeah, we took it to Norway with us a couple months ago, and we're playing with people who weren't necessarily English speakers, But you don't need to speak English to know that you need to play the 7 before the 8. So it was just everybody loved that game there.
And a lot of games, they really are hard to sell based on their theme or whatnot. But once you start playing it, it's really fun. Like you said earlier, like, is being a city planner really fun, you know, or collecting resources and building new roads? Is that what I want to do on a Friday night? Like some of these ones, like I, every day at the store, people are like, can you recommend a game for us? And I'll explain a game that I know is super fun. And they give me this blank stare like, okay, we're putting cards down in the right number sequence, you know, and I'm like, trust me. I was like, if you don't like it, I'll recommend something else. But I think this is good for your group.
You're listening to All Sides Weekend. We're talking about board games, gaming in general this hour. My guests, Aaron Brown, owner of Tabletop Cafe, Cheryl Harrison, founder of the Beers and Board Games Club, and Malika Jacobs, owner of Kingmakers. And something you said earlier, Malika, caught my ear because you said it makes us feel like a kid again. And I think a lot of our conceptions of board games are kind of childish. We think about Guess Who or Hungry Hungry Hippos or Mousetrap, perhaps. But has the industry matured at all since kind of that conception?
Yeah, it's ironic. I think maybe Aaron's discovering this, too. I don't think this is how we intended to open our spaces. But one of our biggest clients has been companies that have come in for team bonding experiences. So it's a strange phenomenon where adults that are working in very, you know, corporate cultures here in Columbus are interested in that dynamic that board games can provide, because I do think that it does, you know, what Cheryl and Aaron have been talking about, sort of allow people to cooperate, to work together, to be forced into interaction in a way they might not normally interact during the day. So I think that's fascinating, that something that is considered maybe a childish hobby or sort of a childish, gameplay is actually really relevant to even our top CEOs, top companies here in Columbus in terms of very adult and difficult decisions and working together with people to accomplish a goal. That's something that's very, you know, adult and mature. But I think board games can really be a vehicle for that.
And I don't know if you have the same experience that we do. When we have these corporate groups in, you have like we always have like a third that are very reluctant to have fun.
This is the intimidation factor.
Because it is like this fear of being silly childish.
You don't want to be like that in front of your colleagues, maybe, is sort of one of the
things
we
like, try. I find we win over those people, and then they're like our biggest cheerleaders afterwards.
Totally.
You know, these like really reluctant people that are really nervous. You explain how to play Telestrations, which is insanely easy. And they're like, you can tell in their face that they're not comfortable and they don't want to do this.
Yep.
And I'm like, you're not at work. You're playing board games.
Yep.
And then like a couple rounds in and they are cracking up. And like all that tension and the release of it and releasing some inhibition and having fun is like powerful for people.
Yeah.
I think one of the most like moving things for me was this one of our regulars said, you know, this place crossed off something on my bucket list. It was to have my own Cheers, you know, like a place where you can go and like, you're known and it is just pure fun. You walk through, you know, Beer and Board Games, Malika's store or ours, and it just like is filled with laughter, you know, this like testing your ground and something hilarious happens or something unexpected happens. Sometimes it's a tension that's built up and then something happens and you just hear the place is full of laughter.
And there have been lots of studies that show that play in adults can really help with brain function. It can help fight off Alzheimer's. It can help with memory. It can help with thinking. It helps with creativity. And it's just something that people are sort of either taught as adults or societally we just don't play after a certain age. And I think board gaming is a really big step towards overcoming that.
Wonderful. We are talking about board games this hour. And before you guys leave, I want to get at least one recommendation out of you for a board game that you would recommend to a relative beginner. What would you recommend to try to get someone into this whole board game universe, which is vast, it seems?
Yeah, this is sort of a strange, this is a very, very quick game. You were talking about fast games. And so we have a collection of games on the shelf called Timeline. I know it's not a hardcore game. It's not a heavy game. It's actually a really simple concept. You're working together to build a timeline through different themes. So it can either just be history or American music or animals or you're just trying to do, and it was Cheryl reminded me of it when she was talking about the about Mind. But I do think that's a super easy way. We always call it an appetizer game. So it's a game that starts off your play. And if you're either waiting for people to join up, so if you have a couple copies of it over the holidays, it's something that people can jump in and play. It works across all age groups. So you don't have to know exact trivia, sort of like Wits and Wagers. You don't have to know the exact answer. It's general knowledge trivia that we all kind of know. And you're working together. So it kind of works again. It's a competitive game, but you are working together to build one timeline. So we have, you know, I think there's like 7 or 8 or 10 different timelines out now.
Yeah.
And, you know, can find a theme that works for you.
Wonderful.
And I think that's a great one.
My pick is going to be this year's Spiel des Jahres winner. Aaron's got to think of another one. So real quick, the Spiel des Jahres is the German Game of the Year Award. And I think that's one of the big drivers for the tabletop game revolution that started in 78. Catan, which we've been discussing a lot, was one of the games that won that title. And I think that sort of cash prize and notoriety that comes with winning that has really helped people develop lots of new games across many genres. So Azul is the game that won this year. It is a very simple game where you are building these fabric wall tiles. So you're just taking pretty colored tiles that look like Starburst and placing them in a certain pattern and trying to make sure you only have one in each row. It plays very simple. It's just a really pretty game, though.
It sounds soothing.
It is very peaceful, yes.
And I'll go, I'll pick a different genre since Azul was stolen from me. but I'm going to say that the Forbidden Island it's a cooperative game, so it's going to be a different experience than a lot of people have had in which you're all working together. So the four of us are playing.
We all win together or lose together.
Correct. You know, and then that same designer has done multiple things. So there's the whole Forbidden line. They just came out with a new one, Forbidden Sky. Then he's also done the whole Pandemic series, which a lot of people are also familiar with.
And that's when you're trying to fight off a series of infections,
yes,
trying to take over Earth.
And like a cooperative game is so powerful and seeing people work together. But like we have people that come in and you offer a cooperative game and they're like, no, I don't want a cooperative game. They want to compete. And so it's not for everyone. But like, I highly recommend getting at least one cooperative game under your belt because it can be a pretty fun experience.
Wonderful. Aaron Brown is the owner of the Tabletop Gaming Cafe. He is sticking with us. Malika Jacobs, owner of Kingmakers, thank you so much for joining us today.
I really appreciate it. Thanks.
And as well, Cheryl Harrison, founder of the Beers and Board Game Club. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Claire.
You're listening to All Sides Weekend. We're talking about tabletop games as well as role-playing games. If you have a favorite tabletop game, if you have a D&D character who's maybe impacted your life, please give us a call. You can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to All Sides Weekend. I'm Claire Roth, your host, and we are talking about tabletop gaming this hour. Board game bars and clubs have popped up. Role-playing games are featured in shows like Stranger Things. And now a play about Dungeons & Dragons is being staged at Columbus State Community College. Sonda Staley is the director of that play, and she joins us by phone. Thank you so much for being with us, Sonda.
Good morning.
So just in a sentence or two, real quick, tell us about the play.
Oh, it is so much fun. It starts out with a narrator, kind of like a Lord of the Rings character, hooded figure, and she starts with, in a time before Facebook, World of Warcraft, and massive multiplayer online RPGs, there once existed simply a game.
And it goes on to be about two sisters, one of which dies, and the older sister finds the notebook, the D&D notebook of the younger sister, right?
Correct. And it's not a spoiler. We know it in the very first scene. And through her sister, we learn about Tilly, the younger sister, through this game and all of her D&D geek friends.
So why do you think D&D is important to this play's message? Because you could find, you know, the younger sister could have just written a notebook about her feelings. So why do you think it's important that it's put through this Dungeons & Dragons filter almost?
Well, it's interesting. The playwright, Gui Gwyn, he calls himself a playwright, screenwriter, and geek. And he just loves all things pop culture, apparently. He's also a fight director, so it's an opportunity to give people all this fight choreography. So the pop culture references from 1995 that it's set in make it fun, and he can deal with some more serious material through that lens. But I think the D&D lens works really well because in the whole gaming, I was listening to Malika and Aaron talk about the play of gaming and the working together. Well, theater is a collaborative act, and you really see that in the gaming world as well, that they have to collaborate to get through this adventure.
Also joining us for the show, Quartz reporter Dave Gershgorn. He wrote about Dungeons & Dragons last month. Thank you so much for joining the program, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
And something that it comes up in this play that Sonda is talking about that I think really exists in a lot of D&D is the role-playing aspect of it. It's this concept of I get to be whoever I want.
Definitely. It's like this element of escapism. You can kind of like leave your life behind and be a, you know, a dragonborn sorcerer, or, you know, you could cast magic spells or be stronger or be quicker or, I guess, more sneaky than you are in your life. And I think especially in 2018 and, you know, all throughout, you know, the game's existence, that's been really appealing to a lot of people.
You know, help us describe what Dungeons & Dragons is and how it works for someone who's never played it and knows nothing about it.
Totally. So Dungeons & Dragons is basically a collaborative storytelling game. So there's a dungeon master who kind of sets the setting, and then each other player around the table, could be two people, five people, are the characters. And it's super open world. They can just say whatever they want to do, and all the rules of Dungeons & Dragons, which there are many, are basically just kind of window dressing around rolling a dice to see if your character is able to do the thing that you said or not do the thing that you said.
Something that I think is really interesting about Dungeons & Dragons is that it's really almost improv storytelling.
Totally. And that's kind of, I think, what has given it this life in media today, where there are tons of podcasts where people just play Dungeons & Dragons for, you know, hundreds of hours. There are a few. I'm listening to The Adventure Zone right now, which is a great podcast.
And I love The Adventure Zone. That's how I got into D&D.
Yeah, I'm on episode like 65 or something. Like, I'm right near the end.
It's going to get so good.
I know, I'm so excited. And I just listened to Drunks and Dragons, which is another one. And I've listened to like 250 episodes of that while I was training for a marathon. And it's just like the perfect thing to just kind of like put on in the background and just listen to vaguely. Because it's a storytelling game. It's just, it's about, you know, people hanging around a table, you know, trying to figure out what to do next in like a kind of difficult situation, and what spells can I cast, and, you know, can I climb this wall, can I break down this door? And when you're put in that setting yourself, it's just like the whole world kind of opens up in front of you. It's like, oh, what would I do in this situation?
Aaron Brown, the owner of Tabletop Gaming Cafe, is still with us. And Aaron, you've played D&D for almost all your life. Tell us how it helps you relate to the other people at the table.
You know, I think you get a lot of people's personality come through their character, and, you know, I don't know, I think it'd be too base to call it wish fulfillment, but, you know, you get to try, and it's a safe place to, you know, try out a different part of your personality. You know, I've you know, been playing since a friend introduced to me when I was in like fifth grade, and, you know, I've gotten to play so many different characters, so many different ways, you know. And your relationship with your group, like, you know, we've had real, like touching moments between, like, characters and stuff, even though they're completely fictional. Like, me and very good friends, you know, we rented an extra room in someone's apartment because when I lived in New York, we didn't have space for it. So we rented a whole extra room, and, like, we would meet there every Saturday. We'd get there at noon with lunch. We'd eat for about an hour, catch up, and then we'd play for about 4 or 5 hours, have dinner together. Like, it was so much more than the game. It is, like, your time with people, and everything they do in character becomes an extension of them. And, you know, and they get to have a chance to annoy you or bother you in character, or, you know, you get to have a fake fight, you know, in a very safe place that's about having this confrontation, but it's not real. And, you know, at the end of it, you move on. So it makes a bad decision, you move on, but it makes the story better. You know, people that think that, you know, there's always a joke when, you know, parents asking people who play D&D, did you win? You know, and, you know, the winning is creating a great story. And so I think there's a certain part of your, you know, gaming trajectory when you realize that it's not the best to succeed at everything you do for your character. Having some big failures end up creating really interesting story arcs, because you then have to redeem yourself. You lose something and you have to regain it. You don't, you know, defeat it, or you don't find it, and then you need to go about doing it a different way. And I think there's a lot of great life lessons in there and a lot of good bonding to do with friends in that kind of situation.
Sonda, tell us how that concept of storytelling and working within this conceit to better understand who you are as, you know, a real person, not just a character. How does that relate to the play?
Great. It's in a couple ways. One is that within the play, we have to have an adventure, which is great. So even if you're not a D&D player, you can experience that concept of the storytelling within the play. Plus, we get to kind of explain the basic concepts of D&D to our audience, which is fabulous. And they really get to see Tilly, the main character who was in high school. She gets to fight her demons, literally. Her demons from high school, her bullies. And she actually does call it wish fulfillment. She gets to have those battles. And then secondly, the thing that I've noticed is my cast. The guy who plays our dungeon master, his name is Patrick Petrilla, and he says these are his two great loves, theater and D&D. And because he knows so much about D&D and other people were curious, they have a game going now, so that he has agreed to be the dungeon master and start a game. And not only did they have that real-life interaction where they're off their phones and hanging out together, they went bowling after our opening night together. And I think that that is quite fabulous.
It creates these social connections that go beyond the game and go beyond the play.
Yes.
Sonda Staley is the director of She Kills Monsters. It is at the Columbus State Community College. You can find more information about it on our website. Thank you so much for joining us today, Sonda.
Thank you.
So this concept of Dungeons and Dragons, it was created, I mean, decades ago, Dave. Tell us a little bit about its origins and then what it led to afterwards. Oh, maybe we don't have Dave. Dave, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, sorry. Hello? So, yeah, tell us about the origins of Dungeons & Dragons and what came after.
Totally. So before Dungeons & Dragons, there were these war games. And basically, you would take armies, and they were, you know, of dozens or hundreds of soldiers, and it was more of a tactical game, whether you could, you know, defeat your opponent's armies with your own. And it was, you know, very, very kind of old school, tons of players on a board. And in the 70s and the 60s, Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson, who are the two co-creators of Dungeons & Dragons, came to this idea about what if you weren't the, you know, kind of the tactician overseeing these armies, but what if you were the soldier yourself? What if you were kind of an adventurer? What if you were in a medieval kind of setting, and you were facing these trials and tribulations, you know, in a first-person perspective? And that was kind of a sea change in the way that people thought about tabletop games. So this game, Dungeons and Dragons, came out, and it sold a few thousand copies in its first year, and then it got more and more and more popular. And now there are 8.6 million Americans who played D&D last year, and even more who are listening and watching people play D&D online. So it's evolved and become kind of like this cultural touchstone, because when they were making the game, they had to make monsters. So the Monster Manual kind of became this encyclopedia for other fantasy and sci-fi creators to pull monsters out of. So if you're watching Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, the Gamorrean guards are kind of like the first generation of orcs. And if you think about the timeline of when those things were created, it's very linear, and you can kind of see throughout a lot of history of pop culture how the Monster Manual and D&D kind of inspired other sci-fi and fantasy creators.
This is something that's interesting to me, how you described how many, I mean, the staggering number of people that are playing it more recently. We really associate Dungeons & Dragons with the 80s. That's when the Satanic Panic happened. People thought, mm-hmm. Oh, this is, you know, leading children down a dark path. There was Mazes and Monsters, a Tom Hanks movie about one such, you know, college student that falls prey to it. We really associate that with the 80s decade, but it seems like it's really having a resurgence right now. Why is that?
D&D kind of set up its own revival. In addition to having this first-person perspective, it was like the first game to kind of introduce hit points and levels. And that's something that through video games, which were, you know, kind of happening, and the creators of a lot of very popular video games like Doom, which kind of created the first-person shooter, was made it popular at least, they were D&D players. John Carmack, who was from id Software, he came up with the idea for Doom while playing Dungeons & Dragons. So all of these ideas like hit points and classes and having like, you know, set races with you know, set personality traits and bonuses, these were kind of set and codified within Dungeons and Dragons and then translated to video games. And since everyone, you know, kind of like understands the basics of a lot of video games, it made it very easy for this kind of generation to get back into D&D because all of these ideas that it created are now very familiar. So it's easy for people to understand, okay, I have 60 hit points. If I get hit, maybe I lose 13 of them. Or when I level up, I get new abilities. So it kind of really set itself up for this big, big comeback. And then, you know, Lord of the Rings has been huge. They made the Hobbit movies. They, you know, Stranger Things kind of brought it back in a really big way. So I think that pop culture is priming us to play Dungeons & Dragons again.
Aaron, what do you think?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the similarities between, you know, Gygax and Arneson being so inspired by the publication of the book Lord of the Rings to, you know, that was a lot of the inspiration was be like, oh, rather, you know, we want to do a Lord of the Rings war game. And, you know, and so if you look at the early classes, it's like copy-paste of, you know, Tolkien era. All, you know, there's orcs, there's the ranger, there's halflings. You know, they even had to change the name because they got a little too close to Tolkien property. And
were halflings hobbits?
And, you know,
he nodded, but that was on the radio.
Oh, I'm sorry. they had such a big influence, you know, that. And then it's kind of just repeating itself because, like, everyone, you know, Lord got really into Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. And then also, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe is continuing to explode. And there's just this huge, you know, resurgence of this, like, genre hobby stuff and everything that connects to it.
Absolutely. I want to play another clip. This is from the series by Dave Feig. It's Freaks and Geeks, and here the titular geeks, are playing a round of D&D, and they've been joined by one of the freaks, played by James Franco.
Lucky, man. I want to be some huge destroyer guy. Dwarves can do a lot of things that huge guys can't do.
It's true. Take it from me.
Yeah, dwarves are really tough. They're good at finding jewels.
All right, fine. I'll be a dwarf, but my name is Carlos.
So we have James Franco there playing, saying, my name is Carlos. And at the end of that scene, I really love it because they're like, oh, does this mean that we're cool now? And this is really stereotypical. It's the kind of basement dwellers, nerdy young men play D&D. But I think that maybe has changed. Is that right, Aaron?
You know, there's always been women and, you know, people of color involved in gaming. But I think that we're definitely seeing a lot more participation, and I think it's great. You know, I'm a big tent gamer, and I want to see as many people enjoying what I enjoy possible. And I definitely agree that we're seeing a lot more of everyone getting involved in the hobby now because, you know, it's the genre explosion of everything on the screen and stuff. You now have a touch point to be like, oh, you really like Hobbit? there's a game that we can play. You probably have heard of it, but throw away your preconceptions about it. We will have a lot of fun.
Dave, what do you think? Is it hitting the mainstream?
I think so, in like a really insane kind of way. And it's like, I encourage everyone to kind of go to their local game store and like see who's playing. Like, I would be very surprised if it were only like young nerds. You know what I mean? Like, I play every week at my local game store, and I hop into games, and it's young people, old people, people of color, LGBTQ people. It's like literally everyone who lives around the neighborhood comes and plays D&D, and it's like such a cool experience to like even just like meet your neighbors. The number one thing that I tell people when they're interested in D&D is like, just go out and play it. Go out and see the people that are also playing in your community, because I think you're going to be surprised.
I think that that can be difficult, though, because as you mentioned, it's set up where there's a dungeon master who knows all of the mechanics of the game. But I think it can be overwhelming because you can literally do anything in D&D. Like in D&D, you can say, I do a handstand, and your dungeon master or your game master, depending on what you're playing, will figure out what that means for the game. Whereas in Battleship, for instance, you can't say, I move my ship so that the torpedo doesn't hit. And so does that lack of rules but lots of mechanics make it difficult for people to get into it, Aaron?
I think it's really important to find your group, because there's a lot of different play styles and there's a lot of different ways people approach the game. Some people say, we go whole session and we barely roll any die, because they just do a lot of in-character conversation and, debate and meeting people and, exploration that doesn't require – there's no stakes. Aside from, the social ones. And there's some people who, like to play it and they just, are moving from battle to battle and kind of hand wave the stuff in between. And there's so many different ways to play it, since it is so open, that finding your group and having, an established and, about 10 years ago, there was a lot of good conversation, a little bit more academic about role-playing games, about how to approach it, and having like a conversation before you start about how do we want to play this? Let's set up some norms at our table. And some people are like, I don't like it when you talk out of character and then say, oh, no, I was just kidding, And some people are like, we don't like that. And then, there's, groups who invented a thing called the X card. There's a card with an X on it in the middle of the table. If something happens that makes someone uncomfortable, you just
have to... Like a certain level of gore or a certain level of violence.
Right. And so, some people who are part of the indie game community came up with this thing called the X card. Very simple. You have it in the middle of the table. If something happens that makes you uncomfortable, you just turn it over. You just move on. You don't have to stop and have a conversation about it. It just means that someone's not comfortable. And so I think that as long as we're having conversations before, and after the game about our experience, because it can be so, emotional. And you are making connections with people. And you are storytelling. Any kind of art is going to leave you exposed to a certain amount. And so creating a safe place for people is very important to establish at the beginning.
Dave, your article that was published in Quartz last month was titled Dungeons & Dragons Created the Blueprint Nerd Culture Still Follows Today. Looking forward, how do you think its impact is going to play out in the years to come?
Well, I think that it's going to play a bigger role itself. I think that the number of podcasts, and there's a movie coming out, which I personally don't have super high hopes for, but I mean, to each their own. I think that Dungeons and Dragons is making a comeback such that people are going to be more interested in the game, and it created that blueprint, and now it's back. So I think that the game itself is going to be more forward, but it's still always going to have the lasting impact that the Monster Manual had, where people now understand what, a dragon's powers are. People, although that was, Lord of the Rings, people understand what a lot of these creatures are. So I think that it's coming back itself.
Very quickly, Aaron, its impact on gaming in general, all the gaming we've been talking about this whole hour?
As I said like earlier in the segment, so many of the game companies came out, at least in America, from, people that were playing RPGs and wanted something a little bit different. Munchkin, phenomenon. They've had hundreds of different versions of it now, all like is very much attached to the language of Dungeons and Dragons. And so I think that we have this huge backlog of people who have played D&D, and then they all became board gamers, and I think now a lot of them are returning to D&D as well.
There you go. Aaron Brown is the owner of Tabletop Gaming Cafe. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Dave Gershgorn, reporter for Quartz and author of Dungeons & Dragons, created the blueprint nerd culture still follows today. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to All Sides Weekend. It's produced by Mary Lee Williams and Kyle McKinnon. You can follow us on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. This is 89.7 NPR News. Have a great weekend.